A look at the post-Gronk Patriots, how good is Josh Rosen? Can young quarterbacks learn to have better pocket presence? And how do you pronounce that state north of California and south of Washington? We are going to answer very important questions on a mailbag episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And Andy, I'm glad you are here because we have mailbag questions to answer.
Yeah, it's good. They do a better job, they being the listeners, they do a better job of, well, I shouldn't say this because you're the one that usually makes our outline, but I was going to say they do a better job of planning the show than we do.
That's all right. My mighty heart is breaking, but we are going to get to mailbag questions. But first, we got to talk with we got to start with a little bit of Gronk talk at the top of the show. He was still a presumed member of the New England Patriots when we taped last week. Then he announced his retirement Sunday evening, and we didn't get to talk about it. So a little bit of Rob Gronkowski talk here. Everyone's kind of looking for the tipping point with the Patriots dynasty, and when is it going to fall off? When is it going to be over? You know, this is one more. one more needle on the haystack. No, one more needle on the camel's back. What's the metaphor I'm looking for, Andy?
Well, yeah, because we're talking about removing needles from, in this case, removing an entity. I don't know. Here's the deal, though. I don't think any of this matters. I think there are two needles that matter for this conversation: Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. And until one of them leaves, I'm going to assume it's business as usual with New England. And I say that knowing full well that Rob Gronkowski is the greatest tight end that I've ever seen, and probably the, at least it's a discussion if he's the greatest tight end who's ever played. And he was still a viable member of their team last year. It's not like he was washed up yet. He was maybe starting to decline. He had not declined yet. So they will miss him, but it's about making adjustments. I don't think it's about, it's certainly not hitting a reset button and anything like that. They just have to make an adjustment.
Well, I guess that's the question. What's the adjustment? We talked when they won Super Bowl 51 about how Martellus Bennett is not Rob Gronkowski, but Martellus Bennett can give you a version of Rob Gronkowski where you don't have to sort of redefine and draw up the entire offense differently.
Right.
I don't know if that's an element they can find. I mean, Martellus Bennett might come out of retirement to play with his brother, and that's one possible scenario here, but there's not really a great option out there.
Their best course for this year is hoping there's a rookie they really like in the first round and they can get him up to speed. What Gronkowski did, he was great at everything, and that was really valuable, but it was just his ability to do everything is where the value derived. So, for example, Martellus Bennett, that, as you said, they didn't change anything when Bennett was in the lineup because Bennett was what I call a five-tool tight end as well. He can catch passes from his usual tight end spot. He can catch them from the slot. He can catch them out wide or on the weak side of the formation, and then he's a good run blocker on the move or up on the line of scrimmage. So those five traits, Gronkowski was great at all of them. Bennett was merely good at them, but you've got to find a guy who can just do them, who can be adequate at him. And as long as you do, then your scheme will remain the same. You're going to move everybody around the same way you do. You won't be as threatening in certain elements of it, but you don't have to change the way you play. Now, if you can't find a tight end that can do all five of those things, now we're talking about adding personnel packages and changing that dimension, and that does impact your scheme greatly. Not that the Patriots can't do that, but that's where we get into the adjustment. I think they're going to have to find a way around. I don't think they'll find a tight end they can just plug in right away.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about, I don't know how, I know there's some rookies in this draft, and you know more about them. Do you think any of those first round tight end prospects are worth A, trading up for, and then B, can they play right away?
You could say T.J. Hockenson from Iowa is probably his closest thing, and obviously there's a Belichick-Kirk Ferentz connection there.
He really Ferentz has respect for Ferentz was Gronkowski's coach for a while there. Yeah,
yep. He has a lot of respect for Iowa players, and James Ferentz is actually on that Patriots roster. He's a backup lineman, Kirk's son. But the question is, Hockenson has a somewhat similar skill set. I think Hockenson is one of the most complete tight ends to come out of the college game in a couple years here. O.J. Howard would probably be someone in the same mold, but can you take him this year and plug him in and ask him to do the kinds of things that Gronkowski did? I think that's too tall an order for any rookie tight end.
And it might be that because New England's offense is built, as Belichick told me when we did that Gronkowski piece, it, next to the quarterback position, the tight end position is the hardest position in their offense to play. And it's built so much on option routes and certain reads and then making adjustments. You basically have to know the ins and outs of four or five different positions. Yeah, and that's just the mental side. Then you got to be able to physically do it as well. So it could be tough if they don't find a Gronkowski, you know, a guy that can do everything. Then I guess we wait and see. I'm sure they'll have ideas. I could see them maybe going back to more three receiver sets in that case. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're a little bit thin at receiver too.
Yeah, they are. That's what makes them. There's no doubt they're in much worse shape now than they were at this time last year. And their defensive coaching staff. Not that this has anything to do with Gronkowski, but it's got to be built still. I mean, they just lost Greg Schiano for however that went down. So it's a different situation. But I go back, Belichick, Brady. They got a whole offseason to get it figured out. I'll err on the side of caution and still say New England's wearing that crown. Until someone takes it off their head.
they do. We're going to talk a little bit Patriots later in the mailbag here, but let's open the mailbag, Andy, because we've got stacks and stacks of letters. This first one is from Phil. We're going to actually start off with a couple of Josh Rosen questions because it's the Josh Rosen time of year where the trade market will heat up for him. But Phil asks, how has your view of Josh Rosen changed since draft day last year, and what is his market value to a team like the Steelers, Patriots, Chargers, etc. on draft day? And this is, of course, all assuming that the Cardinals are indeed going to take Kyler Murray first overall, which all signs point to that. Not a guarantee, but a probability.
Yeah, which I think makes their GM, Steve Keim, look really bad, to be quite frank. I mean, Keim traded up and gave significant capital to get up and get Josh Rosen, then to be there and take another QB the next year. It's been done before, but not like this.
Well, let me make this point, though. They fired a head coach after one season. They brought in Cliff Kingsbury.
Which also reflects poorly on Keim, by the way.
Yes,
keep going.
Yep. And they hire Cliff Kingsbury, who is a unique hire, to say the least. If you're going to bring in Cliff Kingsbury, I mean, you got to get him the quarterback he wants.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not saying it's a poor reflection on Keim, but not because of what he's doing now. It would have been because of what he did last year. He would have had a horrible season last year. Besides, he had a horrible DUI off the field, which he was humiliated about, as he should be. Then he fires or hires and fires, but had the wrong head coach and is basically backing out of the quarterback he took. So that is his ultimate wasted down year in Arizona, but that's no reason to, you should not let that impact how you go about this year, which is why I have said if they truly are head over heels about Kyler Murray, then go ahead and take Kyler Murray. My opinion on Josh Rosen, though, to answer the mailbag question, it's the same as it was a year ago. I think he's going to be in the right situation, and I think he needs the right situation. I don't think he's Andrew Luck or Carson Wentz where he's good enough to create his own situation around him. I think he's a timing and rhythm player that needs the right offense in order to succeed in that right offense. So I think he can be a tremendous starting quarterback.
Yeah, and our next question is from Kay Griggs, and it's sort of along the similar line here. If you ask 100 NFL talent evaluators, how many would rather have Murray, Kyler Murray, rather than Josh Rosen? And one thing, you know, all our people at the Combine who talked to people about this, the feedback was generally Rosen last year graded higher than Kyler Murray this year. Now, of course, stylistically, they're different quarterbacks. It's not really an apples-to-apples comparison here, putting the two up against each other. The stuff that we've heard about Rosen, and again, it's you don't want to go nuts with this because it was a storyline with him coming out of UCLA, but you know, not great with teammates. Not a you know, just didn't really fit in that Cardinals locker room well. And you can kind of say, okay, well, maybe that's going to be a problem forever. But you can also say, you know, he's 23 years old. The Cardinals locker room is not the same as the Seahawks locker room or the Patriots locker room or this team's locker room or that team's locker room. So there's some wiggle room with that, I would think. But, I think the general consensus is for generic offense X, I think most people like Rosen over Kyler as a talent.
Well, his game more naturally fits the NFL, so there are going to be more coaches that understand and feel like they know what to do with him than with Murray. Murray is a unique specimen, and you have to decide, are we comfortable with Murray moving around and running the way he does? And right there, half the coach, I don't know if it's half, but a portion of coaches would say, no, we're not comfortable with that. So that's the end of the Murray discussion for them. So you're right, it's absolutely not apples to apples. But timing and rhythm players typically are everybody's. It's an inconsistent field to try to project who's going to be good in the NFL, who's not. The steadiest type of QB, though, is the timing and rhythm pocket passer. There tends to be less wavering with their results than, I mean, Murray, I view more as a boom or bust style guy. We've seen it boom a few times. Russell Wilson, we've seen it bust. Johnny Manziel. So. And Murray, I think is more than Jai. I haven't studied him a whole lot. I'm kind of starting to a little bit. I think he's more than just a runaround guy, but running around will be a big part of his game, so that has to be heavily considered.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always just a little bit wary of anyone getting comped to Russell Wilson, who I think mentally and physically is just, he's rare. Kyler could be that type of guy, but I think it's tough to say, you know, this is the next Russell Wilson. I don't know if there will be a next Russell Wilson, or perhaps Kyler Murray will be.
Well, but, and the hard part about that, too, to make your point, Gary, is because you said mentally with Russell Wilson, he doesn't see the field the same way most QBs do. Where he is special is when things break down, which is that's a whole you don't teach that part of the game. So it's a different kind of, and I do not mean this at all to say like the guy doesn't have book smarts, but like that's like the street smarts version of quarterbacking. Unbelievable feel and instincts. But the game is taught through book smarts, and that's what coaches are going to be used to. So, no, that Kyler Murray, that's going to get into if he – it's hard. It's the Aaron Rodgers discussion. How do you judge out-of-pocket vision and ability, and how do you teach it? And you got to figure that out with Kyler Murray.
Yeah. I don't know if you do teach it. We're gonna talk a little quarterback stuff coming up here, but this next question is from Eric. We're gonna stick with a little bit of a quarterback theme here. Eric says, "I'm a lifetime Lions fan trying to make sense of what this Detroit staff is attempting to build on offense. From what I've seen of Matthew Stafford over the years, it seems to me he is more likely to be an efficient quarterback at higher pass volumes, which indicates that he is probably more of a rhythm passer. It also seems like the offense that Matt Patricia wants to build, especially considering the Daryl Bevel hiring, is the opposite of that. What I would hope for this new offense is one that marries the run and the pass game better while maintaining a heavy dose of screen and short passing to create volume and rhythm for Stafford." This, I'm still reading for Eric, this gets me to my questions. Do you agree or disagree with these observations about Stafford? Does Stafford's skill set fit with what Patricia wants from this offense? Is there any indication Bevel can and will architect an offense like this? And what does Bob Quinn need to do roster-wise to support this vision? That was a lot, Andy.
That's a lot. I feel like we have to sit down and break this into categories here. First of all, I think Stafford can do anything and everything. I am still a big Stafford guy. He became a more disciplined QB under Jim Bob Cooter. The problem with Cooter was he runs the Peyton Manning type of scheme where in the simplest form, and Cooter didn't do this all the time, but in the 30,000 foot view, everybody line up, preferably in a balanced formation, and stand still and let the quarterback just eye the defense and wait for them to tip their hand. He'll find subtle nuances, and we're going to run a basic offense off of that. That's not how Patricia wants to play. He wants to do the New England Patriots stuff. You motion here, you shift there, get into bunches, get into stacks, and we're going to manipulate the defense. So it was never a great fit between head coach and coordinator stylistically. I think Stafford can do either of those things. At this point in his career, I'd like to see him in that New England approach because I do think he needs to take that next step as having more ownership of the offense. I think he's more than capable of that. What's interesting, though, is Daryl Bevel, Gary, he's never really run that kind of offense before. Yeah. That doesn't appear to have been in his core group of philosophy. But Patricia, I'm sure, had options for who to hire because I bet a lot of people would want to work for a newly hired head coach because there's at least the illusion of job security there. If your head coach's job is safe, your job's relatively safe. And a lot of coaches are going to want to coach Matthew Stafford. So Patricia had his, I assume he had picks, and he chose Bevel.
Well, the way this roster is built, they built up the offensive line, and they traded up to get Kerryon Johnson. They brought in LeGarrette Blount, and then they kind of moved away. They moved on from Eric Ebron. They brought in three kind of blocking specialist type of tight ends. They traded Golden Tate. Kenny Golladay is obviously a rising talent, but it seems like it's built to be a run heavier offense, and that's obviously what Bevel oversaw in Seattle with Russell Wilson.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know.
But Bevel ran a zone-based scheme with Russell Wilson in Seattle, and what these guys have in Detroit are more man-to-man blockers, which is where mm-hmm. I thought New England ran all kinds of things in their run game, and so I'm sure Detroit will do the same. They did last year, and I know I've heard the reason was that they're trying to figure out exactly what best suits Kerryon Johnson, but their run game needs some sort of identity. And I get the sense they know what they want, and Bevel's here to execute it rather than Bevel come in and bring your ideas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before we move on, you know, the Lions know this, and you probably do too, but hiring is challenging. But there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, this next question is from Ryan. A little more roster-building stuff here, Andy. Ryan asks, I don't understand why the 49ers have acquired so many similar-style running backs. Can you give some insight on this?
Well, I was with a head coach the other day, and he said, I can't remember if I said this on the podcast or not, but he said, if I knew we could have gotten Tevin Coleman for $5 million a year, we would have done that, no questions asked. And this, mm-hmm. that's a coach who has reason to be comfortable with his running back situation. I passed that along to another head coach, and they said, yeah, we felt the same exact way. And both of these guys, you know, I think that was just they stumbled into the right situation there. They saw Tevin Coleman up. Bargain on the market there, and they took him.
Yeah, I mean, they had plenty of cap room to work with, and we talked about this pre-free agency with the Tevin Coleman, Le'Veon Bell stuff. Tevin Coleman is not a guy you bring in and plan on having 375 touches. You're going to have him share the load with someone, and I think they're stylistically similar. I mean, that system is so good. I don't think it's really a problem to have two guys who are stylistically similar. You don't have two, like, one-dimensional LeGarrette Blount types. You have two guys who can do a lot of things well.
It'll be interesting if Jerick McKinnon and Coleman are on the field together a whole lot. Because remember, Kyle Juszczyk was actually their third down back last year at fullback. Yeah. Now, that tells you two things. I think it tells you Juszczyk's very smart and a much better athlete than you'd expect for a fullback. And it also tells you they probably weren't very comfortable overall with what they had at running back. So will we see Coleman and McKinnon on the field together? What we do know, they've got three guys right now. And let's even say Breida can be one. I don't view Breida as this kind, but I don't think he's a bad receiver. But they have three guys who are explicitly great receivers for their position and all in the backfield. Juszczyk, Coleman, McKinnon. On almost every snap, they'll probably have two of those guys on the field together, and very few defenses are set up to deal with two-back offenses. Defenses have become very predictable when that happens because there's more stuff in run defense you have to account for, which the more you have to deal with in the run game, the less you can do with your coverages. So it's a simpler game for Jimmy Garoppolo, and Shanahan's the best in the NFL at manipulating like this. I think this is too good of a deal to pass up.
I will say, I understand 49ers fans being a little bit wary of duplicating skill sets here, because that's kind of what happened on the defensive line, where they already had DeForest Buckner, and they had Eric Armstead, and then they added Solomon Thomas, and Thomas didn't really translate to the edge, and all of a sudden they have no edge rushers, they have no pass rush, and this was This was a defense that forced a historic record-breaking low in turnovers last year, and a lot of that has to do with not having disruptive pass rush. So,
well, to be fair to them, though, when they drafted Thomas, they knew they were going to move him to three technique. They never saw him as a pass rush and defensive end. And then Armstead, they inherited from the previous regime, and Buckner, who they inherited, and both those guys fit the previous scheme. So, I mean, but I understand why Niner fans would think and see it that way.
But, I mean, they ended up with a bunch of guys who are essentially interior pass rushers.
Correct. They have. And but maybe they're geniuses because they wound up getting the number two overall pick in a year that has Nick Bosa, plus they get Dee Ford. I mean, honestly, Gary, let's assume they're adding Nick Bosa and Dee Ford to this. The Niners, I think, become the best team in the NFC West.
Whoa, the best team in the NFC West?
Yeah, my heart skipped as I heard myself say, like, oh, is that, you sure you want to go with that? But I think they're the most talented defense in the NFC West, and I think their offense can score 30 points a game in its current constitution.
It becomes a look, it becomes a very intriguing talent. I don't know if I put them up with the Rams quite yet, but yeah, I mean, they're going to add Nick Bosa. I guess the worst case scenario is if the Cardinals change their minds and end up taking Bosa. You can still get Josh Allen, the edge rusher, who's another quality edge rusher, and Dee Ford on the other side, and that becomes a scary defense, which, again, pass rush last year.
We have a Richard Sherman question from someone named Dante. We ought to just answer that now because that is the second part of this conversation.
Sure. Dante asks, was Richard Sherman good this past year? Is he still a top 10 corner in the NFL?
I don't know if he's quite top 10. I don't know. I shared when I saw him at the combine and my icebreaker, I went up to him and I said, I underestimated you this year. And he said, yeah, I saw that. But you've done your job well before, and a guy coming off Achilles, I figured I'd give you a break on it. So I feel like because he was so cordial about that, I think, oh, sure, he's a top 10 corner, but I don't know if he's a top 10. He might be top 10 within the context of this scheme. I think he plays that cover three responsibility really well. But cover three's got a lot of man-to-man elements for a guy like Richard Sherman, too. So can we say top 15? Top 15 make this whole thing a lot easier.
The other thing is, I mean, look, I guess we haven't talked about it, but we'll probably do the position rankings at least a little bit this upcoming offseason. So it always helps to be able to put the guys down on the list and see. I feel like cornerbacks are kind of down across the league. So I think if we're talking top 10 in the most literal sense, I think he's probably in the running for that. But we'll see when we write them all down.
He's a great tackler, too. We got into a conversation about tackling, and he said he just figured out early in his career that – because as a cover three corner, you're often what they call the force defender, meaning you're the guy that they don't have a blocker for. Because your wide receivers, and especially in the NFC West, where the wide receivers, at least on the Rams and the Seahawks at times, they line up so close to the formation. Part of the reason they do that is so that they can go block the safety. Well, when the wide receiver blocks a safety, now you as the corner, you're unblocked. So Richard Sherman is always he's often an unblocked player in this scheme. It's been that way throughout his career. And he said, yeah, I just realized one day it's just easier to be assertive and take on the tackling because whether you're wimpy about it or aggressive about it, there's a lot of contact no matter what. And my response to him, Gary, was, that reminds me of a beard trimmer I have. When I take my beard trimmer and I go slightly with it, it pulls my hair on my face. And so then I'll get mad and I'll just dig the beard trimmer into my face and just cuss my way through it. And it hurts a little bit more, but at least I'm causing the hurt rather than reacting to it. And I don't know if he was I don't know if he'll remember the analogy. But anyway, I said now every time that I trim my beard, I'm going to think of cornerbacks tackling. I have. This all has a point. This cornerbacks tackling when I trim my beard.
There's a lot of life lessons in beard trimming.
Yeah, I suppose. You think so?
Well, there's one, and it has to do with cornerback tackling as well. So
I see yours is trimmed now, and a lot of times yours has gotten out of control in past years.
No, I don't trim it. I just shave once every 8 to 10 days, and then it just grows out, and then I shave it again.
Okay.
That's all. Your beard is looking, it's looking sharp today. I actually noticed that earlier in the show. You look kind of tan, too. I don't know if you've been working outside.
It's the lighting. There's a window right behind me that is skewing the lighting in this room, and it makes me look. I noticed that last night because I did FaceTime with a coach watching film, and I thought, man, I look a lot tanner than I normally am.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the lighting. It's the lighting up here. I am a pale little guy.
Oh, yeah.
It's frustrating. Oh,
it's you look bronzed. You look like some sort of, I don't know, Greek god right now, Andy.
Thanks.
That's a little bit too much, but you do look, you look tan and healthy right now. Next question is coming from Carl, who just asked flat out, how do compensatory picks work? And we'll get into this a little bit. I'm not going to completely deep dive it. I will give a history lesson, and I will mention, first and foremost, one of our researchers, Reed Foster, is writing a piece on compensatory picks and sort of the compensatory pick scam going on in the league right now. But when compensatory picks came in, similar to the franchise tag system, is when free agent, you know, sort of modern free agency started in the NFL back in the early 90s, and ownership had all these sort of, you know, worries, and they were freaking out, and they said, well, we need these fail-safe options, whether it's the franchise tag to keep your superstar quarterback from being signed by the Dallas Cowboys or wherever it was. Compensatory picks were put in for when you couldn't, you know, you lost the bidding war for that free agent, and you want something, so you get, you know, a third-round pick, a fourth-round pick. They calculate it based on who left your roster and who came into your roster, but players who are cut don't count into that calculation. So like Eric Weddle this year doesn't count against the Rams calculation. And also, if you decline a player's option, that rule was changed a couple years ago. If you decline a player's option, he is considered a guy who left your team as far as compensatory picks go, so you do get compensation for them. And obviously with the rookie wage scale coming in, the fact that there's so much cheap labor and that's so much more valuable and less risk than actually paying your own free agents, it ends up being it's a scam. It's an anti-labor scam, and it's just, along with the rookie wage scale, it's just combined to sort of make roster building on the financial side of it just stupid in the NFL. It's a stupid system right now.
All right.
There's your answer, Carl.
That was like a college professor's answer. That was like, let me give you half the answer, and then I'm going to build into the answer my opinion on it, and we're going to treat this as the answer. But I don't disagree with you. I think this compensatory pick thing is garbage, and I don't like that teams basically get rewarded with good picks. These are mid-round picks they're getting. These are not six-rounders a lot of the time, at least with some of these guys. And I don't like that they're getting rewarded for letting good players walk out the door.
And that's what it's become, and that's how everyone games the system out. It's not, you know, for a while it was just the Ravens were famous for kind of doing it, and now it's everyone does it, and it's just it's dumb. It's already a hard cap in this league, and pay the players what they deserve, and build your roster that way. But that's a much larger conversation for another time. We'll go on to Neil, who has a very good question. This is one of the best questions we've gotten in a while, I think.
I thought so too. Yeah.
Neil asks, you often talk about the soft skills of quarterbacking, like pocket presence and throwing with anticipation, which are harder to quantify. In thinking about the upcoming draft, or any prior draft for that matter, are there examples of quarterbacks who have managed to develop those skills where they had been deficient when they entered the league, or are those traits just traits that guys have or don't have? So basically, Andy, when you think about it, are there guys who really, you know, when it came to pocket presence or anticipatory throwing, guys who really, that was not a strength early in their career and sort of became a strength as time went on?
That's a great, great question. Let's start first of all by, I would differentiate those two, because I think pocket presence, that nuanced movement, is 100% vital to quarterbacking. I don't think anticipation passing is. I think that's a little bit more stylistically. Mm-hmm. Aaron Rodgers, for example, is not a big anticipator. Tom Brady's never been a big, he can do it. We've seen some great throws, but that's not his style of play either. It's just, that's a throwing preference and style. The ability to move within the pocket, though, that's what is key. And I had that conversation with some coaches this year. I asked, can it be taught, the pocket presence and movement? And the overall answer, you get different theories here and there, but the overall answer is it's a little bit like accuracy. It can be improved and perfected and honed, but it can't be taught. So you do have to, as Neil referenced, you do have to have the baseline. That's not an easy baseline to have. A lot of it's just having the courage and poise to understand that there might be defenders around me who are trying to hit me, but they're not going to hit me if I move just this little bit. It goes very counterintuitive to how even not just human beings act. If I'm about to get hit, I'm going to get as far away from that source of the hit as possible. But it's even counterintuitive to how athletes act, because athleticism and most sports encourage you to get as far away from the danger as possible. But that's not how quarterbacks are. That's not how they play. Not the good ones.
No, that's a refinement. I think you can refine those things. But, it's the same conversation that we have with accuracy and can you improve a guy's accuracy? You can refine his accuracy. And then it just becomes I don't think Josh Allen was horrifically inaccurate the way you see some prospects are. And I think he's a guy who can refine that accuracy and maybe get to a point where he's sort of good enough.
And a lot of this, these get touched by so many variables. So think about if I'm a QB, I'm entering my second year in the NFL as a quarterback starter for my team, and I need to get better at moving within the pocket. Well, first of all, I got to be comfortable with our offense, because if I'm thinking about our offense and what our play is, and I'm not completely 100% comfortable with our playbook, do you really think I'm going to be poised enough to breathe deeply while I'm dropping back and move within the pocket? Or am I going to get shallow breathed going through my reads? That's part A. Part B is then what about the defense? I got to understand and be comfortable with what I'm seeing from the defense. Is that possible? Then part C would be, what kind of passer am I? Do I have a big arm where I've always been able to just kind of use more of my arm than my legs compared to how they teach it? Or am I Drew Brees, who has the best pocket movement we've ever seen, perhaps, and I don't have a big arm and I need space in order to throw? So instinctively, I have no choice but to move within the pocket because that's the only way I know how to throw. There's all these different variables that go into it, which is why I think it can only be refined and not taught.
All right, this next question has come from Robert here. If getting a QB involves a significant dose of good fortune, can't we say the same about injuries in the draft in general? The Patriots are evidence that winning and losing in the NFL is probably more than just luck. But coaching? Bill Belichick had a losing record in Cleveland over 5 years, so it's not just coaching. Is winning versus losing in the NFL long-term as simple as evaluating a GM or owner, something that most of us don't know enough to judge? Or is it coaching, but assistant coaches are more important than anyone thinks? Basically, Andy, I mean, when it comes to long-term success, and when you're looking at a team like the Patriots, I would say it's a combination of the fact that the two main guys have been there. The continuity of having Belichick and Brady for so long is what has played into it the most. But we talked about last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, perhaps coaching, good coaching is where you start, and then you start building the roster around that.
That's where I would start. I'd start, because what you have to remember about coaching, a head coach, a great head coach, coaches his players, but also his assistants. And the times I've been around the really good ones, you see them teaching their assistants. They teach the assistants how to teach, and it's a whole teach a man to fish kind of thing. So when you get that kind of stability and system in place and you have everybody teaching it the same way, it becomes easier to learn. The teachers get better at teaching it. And then even when you're evaluating players, theoretically, it gets easier to evaluate players because you know exactly what we're teaching. We need this. We don't need that. Our scheme does this. It doesn't do that. Here's what we ask of people. And then let's put on the film of this free agent and see, can we get that out of this guy? And I think there's something to that. So talent is ultimately what matters most in the NFL, your roster talent. But that's 53 variables, 53 roster spots. A coach is a close, narrow second to roster talent for importance, and that's just one variable. You got to get the head coach right, and he's got to get his staff right. That's one variable, assuming he can teach his staff, which I think is part of coaching, which is why I think for another show, an interesting discussion would be the Andy Reid Hall of Fame candidacy discussion, a guy that doesn't have a ring himself but has a lot of success and a prolific coaching tree that has a lot of rings. Should he get credit for that? I think he should, but that's a different discussion. Coaches coach coaches.
Yeah, I agree, and we will have that discussion. But just real quick to wrap up that question from Robert, we say this on the show all the time, there's just not that much of a divide in talent from roster to roster in the NFL, like you see. I mean, Alabama is going to be great because they're always going to get five-star prospects that, Alcorn State does not get, and you know, that's how college football plays out. But you have fairly evenly dispersed talent across the NFL. And
another reason that the NFL is better than college football.
I'm not getting into that because now a bunch of people are going to yell at us for busting on college football.
Yeah.
College football is fine. I enjoy watching it every now and then.
Yeah, it's fine. I agree. It's fine.
Jeff and okay, so this is what Jeff asks, or more yells at me about. On not one but two of your recent podcasts, Gary said the Patriots have kept winning in part because they're lucky to play in a bad division. Indeed, the Patriots had the best record in the NFL when playing divisional opponents. Going back to 2003, the first season the Pats won a Super Bowl, under the current division alignment, their winning percentage against AFC East teams is 792. That's over 70 points higher than the second-best team, the Colts. Of course, if Gary's right, the Patriots' record would be far worse in games they played against teams from other divisions. So here's my question for Gary. How do you explain the fact that over the same 16-year period, the Patriots' winning percentage against other divisions is 775, over 150 points higher than the next team, the Steelers? I want to point out, Jeff. I want to point out, Jeff. I'm not saying the Patriots are only good because they play in the AFC East or anything like that. I think the Patriots realize they have a certain amount of leeway that other programs do not, because of the division they play in. I think the Patriots would have similar success over the years if they were in the AFC North or the NFC East or the NFC North or what have you. But the fact that they play in that division allows them to have a little bit of more leeway early in the season to get things sorted out. And I've heard this about them, that basically they, because of the abbreviated practice time that everyone complains about around the NFL, they can use some of the early season stuff less on sort of hardcore preparation for the upcoming game and more towards sort of sorting out and feeling what they're going to be over the course of the season, because they treat the season like a process, big process.
It's an awful lot of words for a guy that's comfortable with what he's saying. I think Jeff is onto something.
Jeff, Jeff is twisting my words.
A lot of twisting to do that. I'm on Jeff's side on this in the big picture, because here's what I don't like. Every time you've mentioned this Patriots easy division thing, the advantage, you always slip it into the middle of your paragraph, and then you've gone on saying something else. And we've never actually had to hold your feet to the fire about this. What are the odds? Basically, what you're saying then, Gary, is for 16 years, not one, not two, but three entire franchises have been steadily downtrodden for 16 years to a certain degree, and the Patriots have benefited from that. That is awfully lucky, isn't it, for New England?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the end of my sentence, Andy.
I think part of the reason the AFC East teams have bad records is because they're all getting beat twice by the Patriots every year.
Yes.
If you add two wins to every team, they're going to look a lot better. He's frustrated. He's holding his words now his eyes.
I'm not. I'm just about to shout a lot of profanities at you. It's not out of anger, though. It is in part, and it's a small part. I'm not saying it's a big thing. I'm not saying the Patriots are like a 500 team if they were in the NFC West or something. I'm just saying that they are they benefit most from having Brady and Belichick as the constants there, but they also have this little bit more leeway. Let's call it the 10% a 10% advantage over what some other teams have. The fact that they know they're going to win that division every year.
I don't know. I don't know if they think about it like that.
I am fairly sure they do. But
Hold on. I'm going to try. Hold on, because I know how that goes. When you say you're fairly sure they do, do you know something that you can't say on the air?
I would throw it in that category.
Okay, that gives a little more credit, because I understand how that goes sometimes.
Bill Belichick is texting me right now because I let him know we were talking about this.
Peter King was the master at stating stuff that you can't state, but putting it into his opinions. And that's why I always listened and gave it. He didn't just have opinions. He had opinions backed by sources and information and thoughts. And
those are informed opinions. That's how it, how it works. But I don't want this to be twisted. The Patriots would be the greatest franchise of the last 20 years, no matter what division they were placed in. I'm just saying they have this smidgen of an advantage being in the AFC East, the way they can basically approach the season. And as we always say, they treat the season as a whole, as a process, as a chance to refine things as they go on. And not everyone has that leeway. Important ones to finish up here. First of all, Bill lets us know. He claims, allegedly, Andy Benoit, way to correct Gary on the pronunciation of the state between Oregon. Washington and California.
Way to correct Gary on the pronunciation of Oregon.
With the Raiders moving, let's make sure he pronounces Nevada right, too. Nevada.
How do you say that state? I'm curious.
I say Nevada.
Say it again.
Nevada.
No.
Emphasis on the
ah.
It's how do you say it?
Nevada.
Nevada?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's Nevada.
Well, that's what Bill is claiming to. I will just say my wife is the smartest person I know. I don't just say that because she's my wife, but she actually is the smartest person.
She is
person
very
I know.
Smart. I can attest to
and
that.
And I asked her. I said, how do you pronounce the state that is south of Washington State and north of California? And she said, Oregon. That's how it's spelled. Let's respect the language. Let's respect phonics, everyone.
Well,
it's
Oregon. What is your wife smart at? Because there's a lot of categories a person gives. I mean, this is where I tell the Einstein story of, oh, hey, did you know he couldn't find his way home at the end of the day sometimes? There's different brands of intelligence. Liz Grambling's intimidatingly smart, but I don't think that carries any weight that she says Oregon. Versus Oregon, right? That's the adult equivalent of like, well, my dad said so. You get in an argument on the playground. It's my dad says, and my dad says, that's nothing. It's Oregon and it's Nevada. Bill's right. Well, I'm right. The Gramblings are wrong. Next question.
My wife says, and this is from Karthik. Andy, please look up how to pronounce Jaguars. It's not Jaguars. And also adds Gary, please look up how to pronounce Oregon. Andy is right.
I'm
still
going to
say
it
Oregon.
No, I don't know what's wrong with how do I say Jaguars? What am I
saying? You say Jaguar. It's Jaguar.
Yeah, I know it. And the first time I heard that on a commercial, I thought, "Oh, what an ass. Who is that guy think he is selling this the voiceover for that car? What an ass." No, I know, cuz we're not saying Jaguar. We're not saying that. No one says that.
I question everything now, but Jaguar. Jaguars. Jacksonville Jaguars. Jaguars,
not Jaguar. Like
Brandon,
I thought, it was...
give us a
no.
Brandon,
I think
our producer Jaguar. Yes,
he thumbs up. He says thumbs yes. Up yours. I'm not arguing that one. I can see. And someone emailed me once. You listened to the show and said I was the only person since their math teacher many decades ago who says measure, like I'm instead of measure, like I'm measuring something. I'm measure, because they do. My dad and his mom, and I'm probably her mom and her mom's mom, they all said measure. And as soon as that person pointed it out that it's measure, I just like that, I got it right. I never said measure again. Measure. So I will get off of Jaguars and get onto Jaguars, which is
That's gonna be like weird. I kind of want you to keep it at Jaguars.
Jaguars. Well, you know the
that doesn't hit my ear right.
No, and because you know what it sounds like is who did the Sean Connery impression on Saturday Night Live for all those years?
Daryl Hammond.
And
Daryl Hammond on the Jeopardy.
Yeah, and he would like
Schwartz.
Yeah, it sounds like he's saying Jaguars.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll talk about this Jaguars thing. I think I'd rather just have you keep it as Jaguars. It just sounds better coming from you.
No
Jaguars.
No one's ever corrected me on it till now.
Yeah. All right. That's a wrap. We're going to have draft stuff coming up. It's that time of year. We're into April here, so draft show is coming up, but that's going to do it for now. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, for making us sound smart. Although that was, considering the end of that show, that's questionable. Thank you, as always, to our producer, Brandon Nix, who makes us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You are the best. Thank you so much for the questions. We'll probably do one more right after draft, probably like early, mid-May, so keep those questions coming. Talkback at themmqb.com is the preferred way. Just put podcast in the subject line. We are both on Twitter and we are both on Facebook if you want to send us questions or just, give us the business, as they say. Of course, we want you to subscribe to this show and all of the MMQB podcasts. You can get to Albert Breer, Jenny Brentis, and Connor Orr on Wednesdays. They'll be back to Wednesday. They were traveling for the league meeting, so they were a little bit late last week, but that's okay. But make sure you subscribe to the MMQB NFL podcast wherever you listen to the podcast, and you will get them whenever they are ready. And that includes the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys next week.